Hi, this is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing, here to quickly mention that Ian Masters is out today, recovering from dental surgery. Of course, we'll be back at 5 p.m. tomorrow. But for now, we have a compilation of some of the best recent programs that you may have missed. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the business reputation of Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, whose wealth appears to be derived from massive corporate welfare as a result of a vulture capitalist feast on the carcass of the 2008 Wall Street crash. After which Mnuchin bought a bailed-out bank for pennies on the dollars, then aggressively foreclosed on tens of thousands of families using robo-signing of dubious liar's loan documents. Syed Kashani, a lawyer whose clients included the largest private home builders in California and litigated extensively against Mnuchin's One West Bank, joins us. Syed acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act. And we will discuss Mnuchin's amazing raid on the U.S. Treasury that he will now be in charge of. Then we'll assess the 50-year-long U.S. embargo and countless assassination attempts on Castro's life, which just ended with him having outlived 10 U.S. presidents. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon and is the author of A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals, joins us. We'll also discuss the makeup of Trump's new national security team with the addition of a Fox News political hack, K.T. McFarlane, as the Deputy National Security Advisor. Then finally, we'll examine the extraordinary number of Fox News analysts who will be staffing the Trump White House, in part because Trump watches Fox News and gets much of his information from it. Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society, joins us to discuss how Fox News, the Pravda of the Republican Party, will now become the voice, if not the brains, of the White House. We will also discuss the irony, now that Trump is considering General Petraeus to be the next Secretary of State, of the appointment of Fox News analyst K.T. McFarland as the Deputy National Security Advisor, given her past effort on behalf of Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch to recruit General Petraeus to run for president against his Commander-in-Chief Barack Obama in 2012. Apparently, Petraeus's conviction for sharing classified information with his mistress does not rise to the level of Crooked Hillary's alleged crime of having a private email server for which she was exonerated by the FBI. And joining us now is Syed Kashani, who has practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm of Shearman & Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for the Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. And he has acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West Bank through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Syed Kashani.
Thank you, Mr. Masters, and it's good to be on your show after listening for 20 years.
Oh, really? Well, thank you. And you may have missed the opening, but I framed this conversation, I think, rather harshly. We're going to be looking into the business reputation of Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, whose wealth appears to be derived from massive corporate welfare as a result of a vulture capitalist feast on the carcass of the 2008 Wall Street crash. After which Mnuchin bought a bailed-out bank for pennies on the dollar, then aggressively foreclosed on tens of thousands of families using robo-signing of dubious liar's loan documents. So correct me if I'm wrong, but elaborate if I'm right.
Well, first of all, let me say one thing. I wish President-elect Donald Trump well, and I hope that he can shake up Washington. But the way to do that is not to pick people like Steve Mnuchin. Donald Trump and his family made money through their own investments in real estate. Steve Manchin made his money through government corporate welfare. That's the only way to put it. The foreclosure issue that you talk about is in some ways the symptoms of how he made the money and not even the cause. Let me explain how this works. Let's go back in time. There was a legitimate bank in Pasadena called IndyMac Bank. This was a bank. It was not owned by Manchin at the time, and it made a lot of real estate loans, including home mortgages. In the real estate crisis in 2008, IndyMac Bank failed. It was taken over by the government regulatory body called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. Now, when IndyMac failed, it had branches, it had depositors' money, and most importantly, it had a very large loan portfolio of real estate loans, including about $11 billion worth of home mortgages that they had given out to homeowners. Now, Manchin and his partners, who were some former Goldman Sachs people like Manchin himself and other partners, including a fellow named John Paulson, who made a lot of money betting against real estate, et cetera, they approached the FDIC and entered into a deal in which they purchased IndyMac Bank and the loan portfolio at a severe discount. Now, I wouldn't say necessarily pennies on the dollar or something like a 25 to 30% discount, but they bought it at a discount. It's not clear how much of that was cash. It's not clear how much of that purchase was financed by the government itself. And by the way, it's very, very difficult to find out what they paid. That's not very readily available information. Anyway, Manchin and his partners buy IndyMac, and they rename it. They set up a new bank, supposed bank called OneWest. OneWest Bank is still in operation. Now, here's the important point. OneWest Bank was profitable, and Manchin made money. But he did not make money because he's a brilliant banker. He did not make money even because he's a brilliant foreclosure artist. He made money because of the sweetheart deal they had made with the government. In the contracts between these buyers and the FDIC, the FDIC guaranteed to pay and did pay OneWest Bank up to 80% of any loss that OneWest Bank suffered on a loan they had purchased from IndyMac. Now, that's bad enough. You bought the loans at a discount, and you're being guaranteed against loss. I mean, that's bad enough. But the 80% is measured against the face amount of the loan. It's not measured against what they paid for the loan. So that's a recipe for success for the buyers of the bank. It's a recipe for disaster for all the borrowers and homeowners who got foreclosed. Let me give you an example of how this worked. Let's take a simple, basic home mortgage, $500,000, which is pretty typical for Los Angeles area. The Manchin and his group, through OneWest, they acquired this loan and many loans like it. They take the $500,000. They immediately go out and foreclose, which they did foreclose on many homeowners, and as many as they could. And let's say at the foreclosure, which ends up in an auction in California, they sell the house at auction for $250,000. Now, they bought that loan, $500,000, at a 25 to 30% discount. So let's say they bought that loan for $350,000. They've just foreclosed and sold the property at auction for $250,000. They go to the government and say, we have lost on this loan the difference between the face amount of the loan, $500,000, and what we got at the foreclosure auction, $250,000. We have lost $250,000. The government then writes them a check for 80% of that loss, $200,000. Now let's add it all up. They paid $350,000 for the loan. They foreclosed and got $250,000 at auction. Then they get another $200,000 check from the government. So they've made $450,000 cash on this loan, which they bought for $350,000.
But
now you multiply that. I'm sorry, go ahead, sir.
Well, I was going to say, though, in the broader sense, this appears to be profiting from other people's misery. What happens to the people that are foreclosed on? They, first of all, they got conned into these loans. I understand the paperwork was reconfigured with robo-signing, which is, should be fraudulent under any reasonable degree, but it wasn't. It was somehow they were able to retroactively fix the paperwork in their favor. And these people went from aspirants to the middle class to living in their cars.
There's no question about that, because the government's deal that they made with Munchen's group encouraged Munchen to foreclose fast and furiously, to foreclose as soon as they could and as fast as they could. There was no incentive to do the so-called loan modifications or workout or help homeowners stay in their homes. And the reason is this. Under the contract with the government, this sort of secret deal they made, and I say secret, I mean, it's possible to obtain the documentation, but very, very difficult. Under this deal they made, the loss is triggered when they foreclose. If the homeowner is still in the house, there's no loss, and they don't get that 80% reimbursement from the government. So obviously, One West had an incentive and did foreclose as fast as they could. And all of the factors you're saying not only happened, they're documented and found. An investigation by the Office of Thrift Supervision, or OTS, specifically found that One West employees had a habit of robo-signing, of signing fake affidavits, false affidavits, claiming they owned loans when they did not have the documentation that they actually owned the loan. Now think about that. They're foreclosing on a mortgage they don't even own. And they're still kicking the guy out of his house. These were things that were found by the Office of Thrift Supervision against One West Bank while it was run by Munchen. There were also complaints that the incentives caused them to foreclose. And in fact, One West Bank, I believe, has the worst record in terms of working out loans or loan modifications or doing anything to help homeowners stay in their homes, because their whole incentive was built, the whole business model was built on foreclosing, taking the loss, and getting the money from the government. Now, let me just give you a total number here. In their first year of operation, One West Bank made $900 million. And we only know that because they had to report the information as part of the government stress test at the time. $900 million on a failed bank. Now, we don't know how much of that money was from these government reimbursements, but it's a fair bet that most of it was government reimbursement, because if you look at the records of other banks who were not foreclosing and did not have the government reimbursement, they were not making that kind of profit in their first year out after a failure.
Again, I'm speaking with Syed Kashani, who has practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm of Shearman & Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. And he has acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act. So tell us a little bit about that. As much as I find this appalling that this man who's the Secretary of the Treasury has succeeded in this incredible raid on the Treasury, where he's just been able to get taxpayer money, fistfuls of it, at the expense and misery of others, and now he's going to be in charge of the very Treasury that he was able to so successfully raid. That's bad enough in itself, it looks as though the government, after the crash, built in these kind of perverse incentives. So, you know, a lot of people might be listening, might be saying, well, you know, he just took advantage of a government that, you know, somehow when Wall Street failed, they rewarded the failure.
Well, it's one thing, you know, I think Donald Trump at one point said that the real estate crash might be an opportunity to buy real estate cheap and make money. Okay, it's one thing to use your own money and go out there and buy foreclosed property and maybe make a profit, and your own money is at risk and you're taking the chance and maybe you make money and maybe you don't. But it's quite another to make a deal with the government that the government reimburses you for losing money and in the process foreclosing on these houses. I'm hoping myself, as I might say, a longtime registered Republican, I'm hoping that Mr. Trump perhaps was not aware of all these deals that happened before. And when his eyes are opened and he learns more about this information, perhaps he'll change his mind and pull this nomination. That's what I'm hoping, because the people who supported Donald Trump, I don't think expected him to bring in the ultimate Wall Street and government insider to be Treasury Secretary.
Well, the amazing thing is that he hasn't, there's not much on the record, but there is a news clip of him talking for CNBC, which is a very business-friendly network, as you know, where he basically said he's going to go after Dodd-Frank because he believes that the role of governments, the Treasury is to encourage lending, banks to lend, not to have too many compliance officers holding the back, that he really wants banks to lend. That's his pitch, and that he says that Dodd-Frank restrains banks from lending. But what you're telling us is the opposite. They actually turned these loans around and literally punished the people who'd made bad loans and rewarded themselves.
Well, it's not just that they rewarded themselves from the bad loans. They rewarded themselves with government money.
Right.
I mean, it's ironic that this gentleman who made his money from government largesse, is the best way of putting it, is now against government intervention in business. I mean, he made his money from government intervention in business. So this is not, I think Mr. Manchin's appointment is not consistent with what Donald Trump stands for and what Mr. Trump ran on. And I'm just hoping, as someone, as I said, who wishes Mr. Trump well and wishes the new president well and hopes he can shake things up, I'm just hoping he'll withdraw the nomination and go back and perhaps consult some of the people who suffered under the crisis and come up with someone different.
And this is very much what Donald Trump ran against. He ran against the Washington insiders, the inside job. If ever there was an example of an inside deal, is the one that you just told us about, where Timothy Geithner, the head of the Fed in New York, writes $175 billion.
$135 billion
check
of the payment.
Right, and he presumably would have had to check with the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, but still, it's an extraordinary, and that was money was just passed through AIG to these other players so that AIG could pay its bad bets, right? And these guys bet against the house. They actually invested in the crash, right?
They bet against the real estate market. They placed what you might say was a smart bet, but they placed it at the wrong casino because AIG was the casino that banked the bet and they failed. Incidentally, I mentioned that some $10 billion of that Geithner money went basically straight to Goldman Sachs. You mentioned the Secretary of Treasury at the time. That's another Paulson, not related to John Paulson, who was himself a former CEO of Goldman Sachs and whose portfolio consisted of some $900 million of Goldman Sachs stock. Mm-hmm. So the Treasury Secretary at the time oversaw a bailout of his own bank.
And nobody noticed, nobody said a peep, right? I mean, this is the amazing part is, are we to conclude that you've got to ask yourself, where do I get a deal like that? I mean, come on. The taxpayer, you screw up and the taxpayer bails you out and then you get bailed out for hurting the very people who were conned. And, you know, the talk about the ultimate insiders, is that to say that does Washington run this country or does Wall Street run this country, do you think?
Well, look, I'm not getting into big philosophical issues here. I mean,
all right. Well, no, you don't have to.
Coming from the point of view of someone who, again, you know, hoped that Mr. Trump could bring a change to this. It's very disappointing that his first most prominent appointment is an ultimate insider who profited from the government intervention and rigging that Mr. Trump ran against. That's disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Syed Kashani, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Syed Kashani, who has practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm of Shearman & Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin. And he acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act.
And hello again, this is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing, here to quickly remind you that Ian Masters is out today recovering from dental surgery, as we compile some of the best interviews over the past week. Coming up after the break, we have an interview that Ian did with Roger Morris. Just following the death of Fidel Castro, Roger Morris will be assessing the 50-year-long U.S. embargo and countless assassination attempts on Castro's life. We'll be right back with more Background Briefing. Stay tuned.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidda-bidda-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidda-bidda-rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And The Guardian is carrying a story saying that there were 638 attempts to kill Fidel Castro. Poison pills, toxic cigars, exploding mollusks, etc. It is an interesting thing to speculate on. Because I've certainly followed what happened with Desmond Fitzgerald, the CIA station chief in Paris, who Cuban Arturo, I think he was a colonel or a captain, Colonel Cabela, who came into the embassy as what they call a walk-in, the U.S. embassy, and said he wanted to kill Castro. He had the access to do so. He was given all kinds of exploding cigars and poisoned scuba outfits and all this kind of stuff, all of which is in a museum in Havana today. And the one thing that Cabela kept asking Fitzgerald was, who are these orders coming from? And eventually Fitzgerald told him they're coming from the president, Kennedy. And then it turned out, of course, that Cabela was what they call a dangle. He went back to Cuba and gave Castro all the information about how the U.S. president was determined to kill him. Now, this is a long-winded way to say that if there's any credibility to this cottage industry of assassinations, particularly on JFK, the only one that seems vaguely credible to me, and this, I believe, is what Kennedy's vice president and successor, President Lyndon Johnson, who you work for, always believed, was that Fidel Castro killed Kennedy because Kennedy was trying to kill him.
Well, the exploding mollusk I've always thought of as a symbol of American policy toward Cuba, both in the last days of the Eisenhower administration and then under John Kennedy. No question that this is one of the darker chapters of American foreign policy. There were numerous efforts to kill Castro especially after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, but there were efforts even before then. That's what involved the CIA even more intimately than they had been with the mafia, with organized crime, because of course organized crime had been quite intimately connected in the old Batista Cuba that Castro overthrew, owning casinos and so on. All of this is immortalized in the Godfather films, but this is a dark stain on the record both of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, two liberal icons, I suppose, for generations of Americans, and there was a certain coterie of officials in the U.S. government who were entirely in support of this, certainly at the CIA and elsewhere. They were rather gullible about some of these things that happened, as the Desmond Fitzgerald story shows. They were totally unequipped to cope with Castro's popularity. Your other guest said when the Cubans are under attack from outside, they rally to the flag. That's exactly what happened with all of these attempts, and what was seen quite rightly as relentless American hostility, violent American hostility, even though after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States pledged solemnly to the Soviet Union and to Cuba that they would not try to effect the violent overthrow of the Castro regime. Those efforts continued. Again, another stain on the integrity and on the intelligence, general sense and sensibility of American foreign policy, because this was almost always an impotent and fruitless effort.
Well, in terms of the Cuba crisis, though, I've spoken at length to Sergei Khrushchev, the son of the former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, who obviously JFK was trying to deal with at that moment when the fate of the world hung in the balance.
Yes.
What happened then, this is what Sergei told me, was that once the Kennedy administration and Khrushchev had made the deal to de-escalate the nuclear standoff that could have led to a nuclear war over the existence of Russian nuclear weapons, and particularly tactical nuclear weapons in Cuba. What happened there was that Castro was so mad, he felt that the Russians had sold him out, that he actually sent some of his special forces in to capture some of these Russian weapons, and there was quite a shootout. So
yes.
I'm always astounded that any liberal in the West thinks this Fidel Castro is such a great guy. He almost tried to have the world blow up. I mean,
well, and that's very interesting to tell that story, because there was always this tension between Castro and the Kremlin, and there was this sense of betrayal. Treachery, really, on the part of the Russians. Don't forget that Castro was quite instrumental in giving the green light to the installation of Soviet missiles. Thought this was a further guarantee of his maintenance of power. It was because of those reactions, which were known to American intelligence, at least in some outline form, that Lyndon Johnson always believed that Castro had developed an absolutely cold and obdurate hatred for the Kennedy administration, that there was no bargaining with that and no relief of it, and that Castro had in fact been complicit in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And as you know, the historical record shows that Johnson believed that rather devoutly. He was not contradicted by members of the intelligence community who, if not sharing that view completely, at least thought it plausible. It turns out to be, as you said, Ian, much the more, I think, realistic interpretation of this whole notion of conspiracy in the JFK assassination. Of course, it did involve Oswald and all of that trail that we know so well in Mexico City and the rest.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. But on the other side, of course, you can really criticize, talk about criticizing liberals, you can criticize the Kennedy administration. Kennedy administration's response to Castro was absolutely catastrophic. The Alliance for Progress, which they thought, well, we got to organize all these Latin American regimes and Central American regimes to oppose Castro. So what did they do? They sent tons of money, guns, military training, police training to all of these repressive regimes in places like El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala, and Brazil, and all throughout Latin America to stop Castro, and they bred the worst kind of fascist regimes.
You know, it's the fear of Castro and of his influence as much as the fear directly of any Soviet encroachment in the Western Hemisphere, which was used as always as the larger excuse, the public excuse. But it was that fear of Castro and the infection of anti-Americanism in the hemisphere that drove all of that, Ian. You're quite right. It drove American interventions, covert and overt. It somewhat explains the coup in Chile. It explains American complicity in torture. My goodness, we had something called the Office of Public Safety, which was a CIA front program run under the Agency for International Development, which was supposed to be instructing foreign police forces in traffic control and public safety, and in fact was doing a lot of more covert and awful, rather hideous work in torture and interrogation techniques and all the rest. This went on constantly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, on through the Johnson administration, into Nixon, of course, and on to Ford and on through the rest of the century. The reaction to Castro was one of the more insidious influences in American foreign policy in Latin America, and I can argue that it explains most of what the United States did and did not do, and our irrational hatred of that regime, our fear of that regime, kept us from seeing even its more positive elements and its positive influence, not only in Cuba but in the rest of the world. And involved us at one point in direct covert operations against the Cubans in Southern Africa, as you'll remember. I mean, this was an international disaster that stemmed from the Kennedys' original hostility to Fidel Castro. So the man who just died is quite an epic figure, of course, in the history of Latin America and the history of U.S. relations in Latin America, but an epic figure in American foreign policy, and may well have been involved in the assassination of an American president. So it's quite a historic moment.
And of course, we intervened in South Africa, Angola, to prop up one of the most disgusting racist regimes in history, the South African government. So let's talk a little bit about then, in the next few minutes here, Roger Morris, about what's happening now with the National Security Council. Of course, we have a complete, I hesitate to say a nut job, but I think General Flynn is somebody that's very, very dangerous. I mean, Trump himself is an unstable personality, who a psychiatrist could have a field day with, and it's a scary prospect of him being president of the United States. But the idea that the National Security Advisor, who at the end of the day is supposed to be the person that protects the president from himself, the idea that this guy was kicked out by JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, because JSOC thought he was too unstable. My God. And then on top of that, you've got his deputy, where you'd think if you've got a pretty unstable national security advisor, at least put a professional in there as the deputy to deal with reality, because that job is all about reality, not ideology. Well, who do they put in there? A Fox News political hack, a complete ideologue.
Well, you were not, of course, the first one, Ian, I have to say, who called General Flynn a nut job. That was Colin Powell in a leaked email. He had been talking to Flynn's successor at the Defense Intelligence Agency, who had said, well, he was fired because he was abusive of staff and had chaotic management techniques and didn't follow national policy and et cetera, violated almost every rule of the honor and integrity of the American military, as well as ordinary political protocol of someone serving in a senior position. He was elevated to lieutenant general and appointed to the DIA, of course, by Barack Obama, and that even after he had been part of the McChrystal cabal in Kabul, that of course had led to Stanley McChrystal's sacking by the president after the great Rolling Stone article on this runaway general. I think this is a genuine tragedy. If we can look at it with a little more distance, this is a 33-year veteran of the American Army. Started out as an ROTC lieutenant way back at the beginning of the 1980s, rose to lieutenant general, combat experience in Grenada and in Haiti, speaking of Latin America, as well as in Afghanistan and Iraq, gets his baptism in intelligence and his education very much inside the military. I mean, I think he's got a BA from a state college in Rhode Island, but other than that, a product of the Command and General Staff School, and I think the Naval War College and others, other credentials that I've seen, all of it in service training, and then he's thrown into to the interrogation of Al-Qaeda prisoners in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and forms from that this conviction that the United States is not understanding the nature of Islamic terrorism and not understanding the overall existential threat to the country at large. You could argue that this is a man who really was pushed and embittered somewhat in Castro-like terms, we were just talking about, by being fired. He was fired a full year before his tenure was to come to an end at DIA, and by all of the differences that he had with the Obama administration. And like any White House, these fights go on, as you well know. I certainly was in the middle of some of them. These fights go on under every administration. There's a certain amount of resistance from the Pentagon and from people in the field, as there is from the CIA and the State Department and American ambassadors abroad and so on. Flynn really simply crosses the line in temperament and in personality and certainly in political judgment in much of what he did. He's going to be supervising an NSC of unprecedented power. I was one of 12 senior officers on a staff of about 48 or 50 in the Nixon administration. It's now a staff of over 400. It is quite literally an alternative foreign ministry in the United States, and it has enormous power. Flynn will be sitting there as chair of most of the operational committees. He'll be deciding everything from the targets of drone strikes to American diplomatic strategy toward Russia, toward China, toward NATO, all of the realms of American foreign policy. So we've got an embittered former general who left the reservation even while he was in the ranks and who violated military protocol, has come under criticism by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs who recognized this. This is a great American tradition which he violates. But then again, he's working for a president who has violated almost every political tradition in the country. So for McFarlane, his otherwise known as Kathleen, when I first knew of her, she was, I think, a 19 or 20-year-old student at George Washington University who was volunteering as an intern as a typist in the West Wing of Henry Kissinger's NSC operation in the White House. And we had a reference to people like her in what she did in subsequent years. We called it shinnying, as you shinny up a pole or shinny up a tree. She did that with rather constant political calculus and emerges eventually, I think, as an aide to Kissinger on the later NSC staff, not more than a typist when I knew her, but then goes on to work on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and as a spokesman and aide to Caspar Weinberger in the Reagan administration. Leaves and goes off and gets some graduate work, graduate degrees, and really becomes one of the few female fixtures in Republican politics on the national security side, and gets the Fox job, and there she becomes, of course, a fairly well-known personality. But this is someone who is distinctly short on substance and has a decided, belligerent, rather I would call it Cold War II view of the world. She was on the board of the old Jamestown Foundation, which you may remember was founded by a Russian defector, Shevchenko, from the United Nations back in the 80s, and takes a very belligerent view of Eurasia and Russia and China. That's its specialty. Jim Woolsey was a fellow board member with her. She was close to Dick Cheney and to some of the neocons, not directly associated with the neocons in the George W. Bush years, but always a figure in more cold, hardline Republican politics and foreign policy.
Well,
so
just in closing, Roger,
much of a balance here.
Right.
If she's the best we can hope for on the foreign policy side in the White House, it's rather a frail hope.
Right, and she's famous for offering General Petraeus, asking General Petraeus to run for president while he was working as a general in Afghanistan under President Obama, to go against Obama in 2012. And she promised Petraeus that the campaign would be run by Roger Ailes and financed by Rupert Murdoch. Of course, General Petraeus didn't take up the offer, and presumably he was the source of the audio recording of the offer. I thank you for joining us, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals.
And once again, this is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing, here compiling some of the best interviews over the past week, as Ian is out today recovering from dental surgery. Coming up after the break, we have an interview from last Tuesday, November the 29th, with Dan Cassino, author of Fox News and American Politics, discussing the extraordinary number of Fox News analysts who will be staffing the Trump White House. We'll be right back with more Background Briefing after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com.
And joining us now is Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as the director of the experimental research of the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Cassino.
Hey, it's great to be back, Ian.
Well, thank you, Dan. And this does seem extraordinary, the number of people that are going to the White House and are sort of traipsing via Donald Trump's golf course down there in New Jersey along with Trump Tower is pretty amazing. It would seem that, as I was saying, that in many ways, this looks like it's not just going to be the voice of the White House, Fox News, but in effect, the brains.
Well, it's actually not that surprising that Trump is recruiting so heavily from Fox News. In the old days, after you left office, after a Republican administration, you would go to work in a think tank or go to work in a lobbying shop. And while that was lucrative and generally more lucrative than government service, it wasn't very high profile. This is almost more a retirement. It's like a TV show that goes in syndication. That's where the real money is, but nobody's paying attention to it anymore. After the Bush administration, we really saw that Fox News became the place where you could retire to after leaving government service. It was lucrative. You could not only be on Fox News, maybe host your own show, but you could parlay that into a radio show and some pretty big book sales. But it also kept up a national appearances. You're able to be in the news. And having that appearance meant you were more able to go back into the news and back into public life later on. We've seen this already going on with people like Newt Gingrich and Mike Huckabee. After you leave, Fox News is a good place to go so you can keep up your visibility and eventually move back in. And we're seeing a lot of that. So it's not surprising that someone like KT McFarland or other people that have moved into Fox News would be willing to move out back into Republican administration. If anything, this is a sign of exactly how much of an establishment Republican administration Trump is putting together. I'd also take a little issue with your idea that Fox News is going to be really the brains of it, because Trump has some problems with Fox News. There's certainly some big policy disagreements there, where Fox News is much more on the side traditionally of Chamber of Commerce Republicans who really don't like all this talk that Trump is making about trade and bringing jobs back. And so there's going to be some tension there between him and Fox News. I'd be worried that Breitbart would be the voice of Fox News, the Trump administration than Fox News is.
And again, I'm speaking with Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and the author of Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. So it does seem extraordinarily coincidental. I refer to it as an irony that just a couple of days ago now, General Petraeus met with Donald Trump, and he's on the short list to be Secretary of State. There's a kind of standoff between the New York former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani and the former candidate for president Mitt Romney, who is apparently a lot of the Trump supporters aren't happy about. So it's not inconceivable that it will go to a third person like Petraeus. But in the spring of 2011, Roger Ailes sent KT McFarland, who's now Deputy National Security Advisor, to Afghanistan to then talk with the commander of U.S. and coalition forces there, General Petraeus, in his office in Kabul. They had a 90-minute conversation, which was recorded, I'm not sure by whom, at which she offered as an emissary from Roger Ailes, she offered the presidency, in effect, to General Petraeus in 2012 to run against his commander-in-chief at the time, Barack Obama, and Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox News or News Corp, would bankroll the campaign and Roger Ailes would resign and run the campaign. Let's listen to just a couple of minutes of this extraordinary exchange of the kingmakers and General Petraeus.
Directly advice to you from Roger Ailes is...
Do you want to squeeze
her? I'm not running.
And that's not the question at this point. He says that if you're offered chairman, take it. If you're offered anything else, don't take it. Resign in 6 months and run for president. Okay? And I know you're not running for president, but at some point when you go to New York next, you may want to just chat with Roger and Rupert.
Rupert's after me. Look, you know, what I have told people is that, you know, I truly want to continue to serve my country if it is in a, you know, a quite significantly meaningful position. Mm-hmm. And there's all of about two of those in the world. You all have really got to shut your mouths, or shut your, yeah, and shut your mouths too.
Yeah, and I'm only reporting this back to Roger. Yeah. And so, that's
well, and, you know, obviously the chairman would be one of them, and it might be one other, but that's about it. And I'm not going to, you know, don't want to go to NATO meetings for the rest of my life, or, you know, fight service budget battles or anything like that. So,
can I give you the gossip that I picked up about all that?
What's that?
I mean, I'm sure you've heard better gossip, but I talked to some former chiefs about this very topic, and they said, well, you know, the White House is particularly nervous.
Of course
about,
they are.
Well, but they're here, and here's the thinking, that they're nervous about. They feel that Obama had this mandate, okay, the mandate or the, in his own mind. Obama wanted to do Obamacare, which is a sixth of the economy. He wanted to do environment, which is basically controlling all aspects of the economy, and education, which is the future. So he pushed for Obamacare, got that done. They didn't anticipate 2010 results, but he now is going to lie low and be very centrist so that they win in 12 and then they get the other two. Now, what they need, and this is not from the chiefs, this is from political people, and what they need to cement it so that it doesn't get reversed is a third term. And that means 2016 they need to win, the Democrats need to win, and they need to win with their guy, their kind of guy. So that then you have the stuff that's locked in place for a generation. Nobody can come in like Reagan came in and reversed.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's their plan. You're their problem. And so,
they can never believe.
I know they're probably related to Ossie Vysadari, but what their plan is. But they think that if you're chairman, they can't overrule you. They can't go against whatever your advice is going to be militarily. Plus, they have a Colin Powell problem, where Colin Powell, very successful chairman, is everybody's sort of rallying point to run.
Yeah, sure.
Next time you go to New York, you're going to start.
I'd be happy. I would love to see him. Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen him in a while, so.
I think he would very much appreciate
no, I'd love to
conversation.
See him. Yeah.
And
he's a brilliant guy.
He is simply brilliant.
Tell him if I ever ran, but I won't.
Okay, I know.
But if I ever ran, I'd take him up on his offer.
Okay. All right.
He said he would quit Fox.
I know. He said he owned
it. And bankroll it.
Bankroll it?
Or maybe I'm confusing that with Rupert. No.
Yeah, I know Rogers, you know, it's not okay, but. Well, I think the one who's bankrolling it is the big boss.
That might be it.
The big boss is bankrolling it. Roger's going to run it, and the rest of us are going to be your in house.
Yeah, right. Okay.
We're all set. We got the poster on.
It's never going to happen. No,
it's never going to happen.
My wife would divorce me.
Right.
And I love my wife.
Teller is a beautiful house.
We have a beautiful house.
And that is a tape from the origins of which I'm not sure, that was obtained by Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, of a meeting in the spring of 2011 between Katie McFarland, who's now the Deputy National Security Advisor, of a Fox News analyst, and General Petraeus, who is on the shortlist to become the next Secretary of State. So, Dan, That's king making. There's a lot of hubris in that, wouldn't you say?
Certainly. Well, of course, the funniest thing in there is Petraeus saying, "Boy, he couldn't run for president because his wife had divorced him. He loves his wife so much."
Right.
given what we later found out about what was going on at the time, it is. But it also shows the real role Fox News had at that point under Roger Ailes. People think Roger Ailes now as this media mogul. But before that, he was a guy in Republican politics, a Republican kingmaker, going back to Richard Nixon. And he'd been the guy who had been worked on the Nixon campaigns, worked on the Reagan campaign. He's thought to be responsible for Reagan's quips during the 1980 and 1984 presidential debates. So he had been a Republican kingmaker. So it's not at all surprising that he would try and get back in the game, that he would be looking for candidates after he theoretically retired from electoral politics in 1984. So the fact that Roger Ailes had connections with all of the players here meant that he was able to take people like K.T. McFarland and put them in the right place to make his offers. Now, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of hubris to that, and I would actually be a little bit surprised if Rupert Murdoch had actually agreed to bankroll something, given that Rupert Murdoch generally stays out of direct connection with electoral politics. He's much more concerned with making money than making policy. But it's interesting that Roger Ailes is still keeping up that role. So I think Roger Ailes, this is a guy who came into politics during the Mike Douglas show, for goodness sake. And the fact that, you know, it's 2016, and this guy is still playing a role, a major role in Republican administrations, and that his, even if he's not, doesn't have a major role, his loyalists that came with him through the Fox News are still having a role. That's amazing. I mean, to some extent, the story of Fox, the story of Roger Ailes, is the story of the Republican Party in the 20th century.
Well, this is a 90-minute tape. The meeting took place over 90 minutes back in Kabul in 2011. And what I found extraordinary about the full tape is that Petraeus is actually very thoughtful about what he wants to do, and he's trying to explain to K.T. McFarland why he wants to take over the CIA and how he sees the future of warfare and intelligence and the role of the CIA. And she keeps she keeps talking like a political hack, doesn't get what he's saying. It literally doesn't get what he's saying. And it's shocking to think that she's the Deputy National Security Advisor. I mean,
well, we have to understand that the Fox News and Ailes are much more concerned with packaging than they are with policy. It's always about how do we package this to make it more appealing. And there's much less concern with the actual intricacies of policy. The thought is, well, the policy will work itself out. Our job is to score political points. Ailes famously talked about the stage theory of politics, where the idea is if two people get on a stage, one of them trips and falls in the orchestra pit, and the other gives a great speech, who's the audience going to talk about tomorrow? Right? Your job is to be the guy who falls into the orchestra pit, because that's going to suck all the air out of the room. And if you can get Petraeus in there, you get him to run for president, he has all these ideas about policy, whatever. Well, that doesn't matter. What really matters is he is a great vessel. He is great for packaging. He is great for appearances. And that's what Roger Ailes' genius really is. You know, if you're talking Richard Nixon, you don't talk about his policy. You don't talk his personality. You find phrases that will get the public behind him. And that's what Ailes is good at, and that's what he's still good at. And we should note, that's actually fairly dangerous in politics, because people wind up supporting stuff without having any idea what they're really supporting, because what they're really supporting is the idea that's put forward, the vision that's put forward, rather than the actual concrete policy proposals.
Well, talking about falling into the orchestra pit, Donald Trump pushed the envelope in that regard and became president. And he didn't change. He was faithful to Donald Trump with all of his shortcomings. That's an amazing situation we're in. I thank you for joining us, Dan Cassino. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure speaking with you again, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dan Cassino, who's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University. He also serves as the director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. And his latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society.
And before we sign off, again, this is Graham Fitzgibbon, producer of Background Briefing, here compiling some of the best interviews from over the past week, as Ian is out today recovering from dental surgery. Of course, Ian will be back again tomorrow for another Background Briefing. Till then, bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.